the Miller Center is more dependent than we ever confess on good friends and people with long memories, and Mark Marford is both. He is distinguished professor of classics. About a year ago, he was instrumental in arranging a discussion here with Professor Eric Gruen of the University of California at a time we were working on the subject of rhetoric and on the historical as well as the contemporary scene. He also is responsible for our meeting today, and it seems to me it's entirely appropriate, therefore, that Professor Marford should introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ladies and gentlemen, this comes as a quite a surprise, but it is indeed a pleasure to introduce a friend of some 45 years standing now. We were scholars at Winchester College together many a long year ago, and then at Trinity College, Oxford. Sir Patrick Mobley has spent his whole career in the British Foreign Service, serving in Baghdad and Dakar and other distant parts, before serving in London, where he was Assistant Undersecretary in charge of dealing with NATO and with defence. And following that responsibility, he became British Ambassador to Israel in Tel Aviv, where he served for a number of years. And then his last tour of duty was as Ambassador to Pretoria. He returned from South Africa this year and is now on appointment at the Center for International Affairs at Harvard University, which I must say is a great pleasure to us that we've been able to bring him over this side of the water for this posting. I think probably that is sufficient introduction, except I would like also to introduce Lady Mobley, who is sitting beside her husband here, and indeed it's so nice to be able to welcome them both here to Charlottesville and to the Miller Center. So without more ado, I'd like to present to you Sir Patrick Mobley.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my first need is to establish whether people can actually hear what I'm saying, because I'm not a great shouter. Is it all right? If I fade away, what do you say? Because there's nothing worse than seeing mouths open and no words reaching you.
I think you're wired.
you've got an overplay, right? Good. The second thing is that Professor Thompson, you suggested I might usefully set South Africa in the wider context of the superpower relationship. So I thought I'd start perhaps by talking about the wider setting of South Africa and then turn to the view from within South Africa itself. And knowing that there were going to be more than just half a dozen people listening to me, I jotted down a few notes for myself. So what I want to do is talk for not too long, I hope, and then it's sometimes more interesting actually to get to the discussion stage and all questions and points of view welcome then. One of my predecessors spoke about the knife edge on which any ambassador has to operate, and of course he was referring to any British ambassador in South Africa. It is a tricky job, and maybe the first thing I should establish is why South Africa matters to us. To us, particularly the British. Well, the first reason, obviously, is apartheid. We have to declare apartheid as an offence against humanity. It's unjustifiable, and what's more, it's unworkable. Even the South African government, I think, have realised that in its old form it's unworkable, and they've made some changes. They ought to be changing two things. One is the discrimination against black people. The other is the denial of political rights to black people. They've got a little way on the discrimination side, but they haven't got anywhere on the political rights. South Africa is unique because it's the only country in the world where racial discrimination is now enshrined in law and backed very strongly by all the apparatus of the state. So what's needed is to see change arrived at peacefully, we hope, fundamental change, which will enable there to be a really representative and a non-racial system of government which the people of South Africa as a whole can accept. That's what we hope to see. I said that we in Britain have particular reasons for taking an interest in South Africa, even more for historical reasons than is the case in this country. And it can be summed up in people and trade. People, first of all, there has always been knowledge in Britain of where South Africa is. We've done business with South Africa for so long, and so many British people went to South Africa that not every family, but many families have distant relations, at least, who are in South Africa. And today there are, by our best guess, which is a very approximate one, there are something like 500,000 people with a British passport in South Africa, and maybe nearly as many again who could get a British passport if they applied. They're entitled to it. So there are a lot of British people there. There are visitors who go both ways. The trade done between Britain and South Africa, if you add it together, comes to something like $2.5 billion a year. There's substantial British investment. The biggest single outside source of investment is British. A little less than there was, because as in this country, some firms have pulled out, but the bulk still remain. Anyhow, there are both historical and modern day reasons why people in Britain take a lot of interest in South Africa. And the third reason why South Africa matters is really strategic. Strategic is a very umbrella word, and if you think what it encompasses, the two obvious areas that I think most people are aware of, firstly, its position in relation to sea lanes, and secondly, the minerals that come from South Africa. Now, the first settlement at Cape Town was not because the Dutch thought it looked a marvellous place to settle, it was because it was on the way somewhere. It was on the way to the East Indies for the Dutch. And South Africa has long remained a place on the way for ships. A lot fewer ships nowadays, because there's just less shipping anyhow. And those that do go, many of them can go past South Africa without needing to stop, but they're out at sea. So it remains a potentially important place in naval terms, in global terms, because of the shipping routes. Minerals, everybody knows that gold and diamonds come from South Africa. In fact, 40% of South Africa's entire exports are in gold. Luckily, gold and diamonds come from other places too. But there are some minerals, like chrome and platinum and others, which come largely from South Africa, or the main supply for the world comes from there. So we do really need those, and that gives the United States, Britain, other European countries an interest in keeping open that supply. I ought to mention two other respects, which are less obvious, in which South Africa is strategic. One is that it's one of the land areas close to the South Pole. I say close, I mean it's all relative, it's not that close, but close to Antarctica. And Antarctica is the largest remaining land mass, which really has not been used or occupied or developed by people, and one day in the future, who knows, it may be valuable for its resources. And South Africa is definitely a window onto that area. The second respect, sometimes mentioned, is the fact that South Africa is capable of becoming a nuclear weapon state. Some people think that it actually has that capacity already. It has an enrichment facility which it developed, which is not open to international inspection, and it is possible that South Africa could have got a long way down the route to being able to have its own nuclear weapon, or if not now, could be near it. And it would then, if this were to be the case, be the first such in Africa. In that respect, it's just worth noting that both the United States and the Soviet Union would take a common view that it would be regrettable if South Africa did become a nuclear weapon state. Which brings me to the last way in which South Africa is strategic, namely the fact that there is superpower rivalry. I suppose it's true to say that for neither the United States nor for the Soviet Union is South Africa or Southern Africa, the whole of that region, of the first degree interest. Nobody in the State Department has told me this, but I suppose it's about a second degree interest for the United States, and I guess for the Russians it's probably about a third degree interest. I mean, that is going downwards. Europe, the Middle East, the Far East are far more important to the Soviet Union than anything in South Africa or that area, and North Africa is more important to the Soviet Union than Southern Africa. So there is a Soviet interest. Russians, I think, have become more pragmatic in their dealings in Africa. They are opportunist. They exploit any opening they see. They have a number of clients whom they are prepared to back and to help. But the American presence is more substantial, it's broader, it's more obvious, it's more perhaps it's far deeper in terms of trade and so on, so one's more conscious of the American interest. Certainly seen from South Africa, the Americans are there, the Russians are not. Each of the two superpowers has an interest in not allowing the other to become the dominant political power in the area. And that it doesn't mean to say they each want to feel that they've got to be the very top, but they don't want the other one to be. So there is an attempt to exclude the other. Now the Russian presence and the Russian interest is absent in South Africa itself, but very noticeable in one or two of the countries which neighbour South Africa. And perhaps I could talk for a minute about two of them. One is Angola and the other is Mozambique. Now in Angola, I suppose out of this whole area, that is the country where there's the greatest potential for superpower confrontation. You have on the one side the Angolan government, and it's backed by Soviet advisors, the Soviet weaponry, and a lot of it. There are Cuban troops, who one supposes to be there consistent with Soviet wishes. And on the other side you have Savimbi and his UNITA movement, and you have some American assistance to UNITA, and you have the South Africans. The American calculation must be that if Savimbi and UNITA manage to avoid being crushed by the government, in the end they'll have to sit around a table like this and work out some compromise between them in which everyone has a share in running Angola. That I think is an entirely laudable aim, but at the minute it's not actually happening, and one has to question whether it will in fact happen. The South Africans have an angle of their own to explain their backing for UNITA. The South Africans are interested because they are still running Namibia, which is one country further down the map, further south from Angola. And the people whom they are challenged by in Namibia are SWAPO, and SWAPO operate out of Angola. So the South Africans keep SWAPO at arm's length by operating themselves into Angola, and they've certainly been doing this for some time, on and off, and they've had to admit recently that they are there again, and that there are South African troops operating in Angola. It's the only country in the area where the South Africans have to admit that their forces are operating on somebody else's territory. The other country where the Russians take a particular interest in this area of southern Africa is Mozambique. And it's tempting to think of Mozambique and Angola as being very similar in that they were both Portuguese territories. They were Portuguese colonies before independence. They've both got a civil war. They've both got a Marxist government, and they've both got Soviet advisors and have had Soviet help. I think, though, that one shouldn't take the comparison too far. For one thing, Mozambique is much closer to South Africa. And remember, I'm looking at it now partly through South African eyes. Mozambique is an actual neighbour. They have a common border. Angola is miles away, further up the map. At least it feels miles away. Mozambique really matters more to South Africa than Angola does. The South African government have been ambivalent as to what best suits them in Mozambique. Is it a settled regime and a prosperous country, or is it a completely unsettled country which poses no threat? I don't think they've made up their minds, but probably it's the former which is in the long-term interest of South Africa, and I think of ourselves, namely that there should be a confident, settled country in Mozambique, which would be one that the South Africans can cooperate with. Hence the Nkamati Accord of about 3 years ago, when they did come to an understanding between South Africa and Mozambique, though that looks as if it's just only just holding, it hasn't been denounced, but it hasn't come to anything. I've mentioned UNITA in Angola. In Mozambique, you have RENAMO. Now, I don't think the two movements are comparable in one important respect, namely that UNITA, you can imagine its leader sitting at the conference table with a program of his own and very clear ideas about how to run that country. In Mozambique, it's hard to imagine RENAMO playing a similar role. They seem to be a very effective guerrilla movement, but they don't have a political program. They don't seem to have effective political leadership, and it's not clear what they would want or how they would operate. They don't seem to have the political organization to play a permanent part in the running of their country. There's a third respect where I think there's an important difference, namely that under Machel and then under the present leader in Mozambique, Chissano, there has been a distinct move of that government away from depending on the Russians. And they've made a strong bid for Western support to the Americans, to the British, to the Germans and to the French and others, and get away from having to depend on their Russian advisors and their and the Russians as their main support. And this is something which I think can be encouraged because it does look genuine. And that indeed is why Britain, for one, has taken a leading role in trying to provide help of various kinds to Mozambique. Well, that's taken me rather around the area before getting to South Africa. So let's look at it from the South African government's angle for a minute. And I think there are two points to make. One is that the South Africans do very clearly see their region as a whole. They don't think of themselves as just a country and that's it, and it doesn't matter what happens elsewhere. What is happening in the region as a whole matters very much to South Africa. The government have persuaded themselves that they are facing what they call total onslaught, meaning a master plan worked out in Moscow to take over the whole region, replace the whites in South Africa by black government subservient to Moscow. And they think it's all part, as I say, of a master plan. It's led them to not only keep the ANC at arm's length by prohibiting it in South Africa, but to lump the South African Communist Party in with the ANC. Now, undoubtedly, there's a lot of common membership at the top, but it's far from clear that it's been a wise tactic, because the ANC is undoubtedly popular amongst the black people of South Africa, and because the Communist Party is, they are told, so close to the ANC, many blacks think, well, in that case, the Communist Party must be a good thing. It would have been more clever on the South African government side if they'd let these people come out in the open. And the communists would have had to compete against others, and I think would not have found that, as such, they had tremendous support. The experience elsewhere in Africa suggests that black leaders who eventually lead an independent country are more interested in their own country and in its national role and national identity than in gratitude to Moscow. And maybe the South Africans have done themselves no good service by, as I say, forcing people to think of the ANC and the Communist Party as almost one. The other way that dominates South African government thinking about the area is that their obsession is with the ANC as a terrorist organisation, as a threat to them. Countries around are capable of providing support and bases for the ANC to operate from. Therefore, the South African interest, this is how the government argue, is to make sure that the governments of these surrounding countries don't actually allow the ANC free run of their countries from which they can then attack South Africa. So the South Africans have used two methods to try and frighten their neighbouring governments into not giving direct support to the ANC. One is military means, and the South Africans have been across borders all too often in the past with raids, sometimes publicly admitted raids, sometimes deniable operations. Sometimes the mere threat that they will do it has been enough, but they are prepared to use military means against their neighbours. And the second is economic leverage, because the South Africans realise, and indeed they are right, and we fully accept that this is so, that the economies of those surrounding countries are very closely linked to the South African economy. South Africa being a strong economy relative to the others, the weaker neighbours really are at the mercy of South Africa if the South Africans put the screws on. Something like 70 to 80% of all the external trade of some of these neighbouring countries goes through South Africa. All is dependent upon the South Africans lending rolling stock for their railways, as applies in Zimbabwe. Or supplies of aviation fuel from South Africa, as applies in Zambia. Or electricity for their national grid. Well, it isn't national, but anyhow, what passes for it in Mozambique. And in the case of Lesotho, which is entirely surrounded by South Africa, all South Africans have to do is simply close the frontier, and nothing can come into Lesotho. So it gives them an enormously strong leverage over the governments of their neighbours. And I think it's consciousness of that that makes the British government, for one, think that one of the most useful things to do at this stage is to try and build up the economies of the surrounding states so that they are no longer so dependent upon the South Africans. Should I go on for 5 more minutes?
Sure.
If I can compress it into that time. The internal view of what's happening in South Africa. Well, there's a great deal one could say, but that's the main points. The government say they are trying to change things. Now, from outside, it seems sometimes as if nothing has changed. I personally think that some things have changed, but they are not the central things. They are some of the discriminatory laws about where you can go and eat or stay or have a job. But the really fundamental changes have still to come. The government are very strong on accompanying change with law and order, and it's desperately obvious to anyone who visits South Africa. There's a state of emergency. I mean, all those terrible pictures one sees on the television, or used to see, because part of the clampdown has been to make it well-nigh impossible for journalists to report on what's going on. But the government don't apologise for that. In fact, they say the only way you can achieve change successfully is to do it in conditions of law and order being maintained. I think it's wrong to imagine either blacks or whites in South Africa as being static. Whites are shifting, blacks are shifting. And I sometimes think of it as two lines running more or less parallel. At the minute, they simply aren't converging. The question is whether they will converge. And I'm not sure that it's possible to say for certain. And one has to be doubtful, in fact, whether what's happening will enable the two lines to converge. Because although I'm confident that whites are moving, by and large, so are blacks. So as whites gradually get to one position, blacks have left the point opposite that and expect something more than they did earlier. Black unrest is being bottled up, and I think the blacks will become more desperate as time goes on. The whites are being pulled in two directions. The more obvious one is that they are becoming even more determined not to be pushed out. You had a white election earlier this year, and the people who made the biggest gains were the right wing. But there are some more hopeful signs. Within the Dutch Reformed Church, they now take the view, a remarkable change, that apartheid is actually a sin. Doesn't mean to say they've got a clear idea of how to get rid of it and what should take its place, but anyhow, the theological basis for apartheid has been declared no longer to apply. Within the secret society, the Broederbond, there are people at the top thinking in a new way. Within the universities, the Afrikaner universities, I ought really to say one particular university, there are people who are really speaking in a way which couldn't have been imagined, say, 10 years ago. And even in politics, there are a handful of Afrikaners who would go further than the government. But the bulk of the Afrikaners are still very, very unwilling to be rushed, to be told from outside, to feel that other people know better than they do how things should be worked out. And this really is why the government have failed to get what they are offering, which is a round table conference or negotiation or dialogue with representative black leaders. The government don't have the flexibility which would enable them to sit down with people like the ANC, who undoubtedly have widespread black support. They will only allow a few selected blacks to come to the table, and as a result, none do, or at least none have till now. I think I'll stop there. we can talk about the role of outside governments in how to influence what's going on, or any of the things which I've been discussing, and the tougher the questions, the better, if you like.
Who'd like to ask the first question? Professor Kern?
Have the whites drawn any lessons from developments in Zimbabwe where the white minority regime was coined by the white regime? And if so, what lessons have they drawn?
Yes, they have drawn lessons. But they've drawn two lessons. Or rather, some whites in South Africa have drawn one lesson and some have drawn another. A small number of whites in South Africa can see that in Zimbabwe they've been independent for 10 years or a bit less, that whites can still live in Zimbabwe, that the country functions not too badly, and that even though it's a black government, whites are still welcome. And in fact, some have gone back. So oughtn't that to be reassuring to whites? Unfortunately, more whites in South Africa would take the opposite view, the pessimistic view, and say the economy in Zimbabwe is worse than it was. They can't stop, terrible atrocities happening from time to time. It's heading towards a one-party state. The one party obviously will be black. Things will get worse. We don't want any of that here. And I'm afraid that taken as a whole, therefore, it's not seen as a promising precedent. I think they're wrong, because in fact, they ought to be reassured, but many of them are not.
Next question. Yes, Mr. Brown.
I'd be curious, as to your opinion, due to a lot of, I guess you call it political crisis in this country, a number of American corporations have pulled out of Africa, South Africa, either they sold the plants or closed them down or whatever. Do you think that does any good, or is it really bad for the Africans? American corporations will take the position, well, if we're the most enlightened employers over there, and give opportunities. And I'm just wondering, does it have any effect on the government toward the direction of doing away with apartheid?
Not much.
I suspect it.
I know this is a very sensitive issue, but I think that from the South African end, if you took your decisions purely in terms of how can we most usefully contribute to getting rid of apartheid, you wouldn't withdraw from South Africa. There are reasons at this end, which I think proved stronger, that companies have felt they simply can't stay. I'm sure the process will continue. More will leave because of all the pressures that have been generated upon them. But has it made any difference? Very little. It hasn't made much economic difference because those businesses haven't simply stopped. They've been bought by South Africans. White South Africans, in fact, who don't feel quite so conscientious about, working conditions or contributing to the community at large. And if you look at the record, neither... Is it called divestment or disinvestment? I use disinvestment, meaning...
Divestment is
okay,
often used here, I guess.
Right, firms pulling out, anyhow. What I call disinvestment, which has happened at the same time as Western governments have applied various governmental measures. I mean, the sanctions package here of just over a year ago, and similar packages in London and in the European community. What's happened in the last 18 months or so is that the earlier reforms, the earlier changes, stopped in their tracks. And there has been no major reform, that there's been no reform I can think of since the main sanctions packages were introduced. On the contrary, what's happened in South Africa has been an even stricter state of emergency, even more people held without trial and so on, and more curbs on the press. So I don't think we can point to anything which says firms withdrawing governmental sanctions have got them moving at last. I mean, the actual story suggests the contrary, if anything.
That's been my impression, if you're just actually backfiring a little bit.
It sounds as if I'm totally against what's happened, which is not the case, because although in the case of firms, I think they can contribute more by staying than by leaving, I do think that some measures taken by governments are worth doing, because they don't force the government in South Africa to do things it doesn't want to do, but they are a clear signal of how strongly we feel about it. And I think the political signal is valuable. And there is, in fact, you know, a list this long of British sanctions against South Africa. Mrs. Thatcher is against further sanctions of a rather undiscriminating sort. But we already apply a number of sanctions, and the South Africans are in no doubt at all that we're serious when we say, you know, get on.
Yeah.
The difficulty is to find things which don't ruin South Africa, but will move that process along towards getting rid of apartheid. And it's very, very difficult to think of things which, you know, fit the bill.
Thank you.
Sector.
Could I take that question just a little longer, a little further in the other direction? What is the danger, and what would we be likely to do? We and you and other Western countries, which would carry the real danger of polarizing the situation in the country. That is, of pushing the white government toward the far right. The black ANC's position further, so that the consequence of violence was a resolution to real large-scale violence was more rather than less likely.
Well, I didn't talk much about the deeply ingrained feeling amongst the Afrikaners that they aren't going to be pushed around. I mean, it's in their history. They 150 years ago, they moved out of the Cape areas further north to escape from the British. They then had an attempt to establish their own independent republics nearly 100 years ago, and the British and the Afrikaners fought a war over it. And the same mentality exists today, that they are damned if they are going to be told what to do and be pushed around. So too much in the way of, you know, economic ruin for their country is likely to drive them initially into the lager, well, people call it that, but in other words, into a position where they say, we'd rather fight than give this up. So it is at least possible, though nobody knows for certain, that all-out comprehensive sanctions applied by everyone would have that effect. There has been a set of views by people who have the good of South Africa at heart, but perhaps haven't thought it through fully, that there are really two choices. One is violence, you know, that things will simply get more and more violent and South Africa will go up in a tremendous explosion. That's one possible scenario. The other is sanctions, and that if everyone applies really strong economic sanctions, that will be the alternative route to getting a change. I think that's wrong. They're not alternatives. Because, for the reasons I've been mentioning, it's entirely possible that too strong sanctions would lead to violence by polarising. It would ruin the economy. It really would polarise black and white, and would make violence even more certain as the outcome, or it would come faster anyhow. So those two aren't fair alternatives, violence or sanctions. There is a third route, which is, I have to say, something like what's happening now. That is continued pressure and continued time for people in South Africa to change.
Yes, Victor. Thank you.
So, Patrick, in the past there have been governments in South Africa which were the majority, which were basically Anglo-Saxon or English speaking. They were not too many years ago. What's the possibility of the opposition government, opposition party rather, people of British descent, enlarging their base, maybe bring in more former Rhodesians and maybe some more moderate blacks and becoming majority government in South Africa?
It's a nice,
moderating the situation.
Well, it's a nice thought, but I'm afraid it's not on. It's not realistic for two reasons. One is that amongst the whites, a very approximate balance is 60% Afrikaner and 40% English speaking. So the Afrikaners are in the majority among the whites, which is why they elected a government in 1948, which has been reconfirmed at every single election since. Because left because they couldn't face living in a country with blacks running it, and most of those are very right-wing and support at least the present Afrikaner government or people to the right of it. So I don't really see an alternative white government taking over. It will be an Afrikaner government which has to change from within. In fact, one of the points perhaps which I come away convinced of is that in the end the changes which matter in South Africa will come from within the country rather than be imposed or triggered from outside.
I correct you on one small matter.
Several.
In 1948, when the National Party came to power, it came in with about 43% vote, which was pretty typical, because as you know, the constituencies in South Africa have always been weighted since 1910 towards the rural districts. And hence, the importance of the Afrikaner has not rested on their total vote, so much as the distribution of the vote in the small rural constituencies, a situation which has obtained. If you look at the votes, until very, very recently, the National Party never commanded 50% of the vote. And the only reason the Republic was brought into play in 1961 was because the vote was gerrymandered. No South Africans living abroad, which were large numbers, were permitted to vote. And they made it by about 0.2%, as you know. And this has been the pattern. And many of us have blamed Smuts when it would have been possible during the years from 1939 to 48 to change the balance of the population in the constituencies to a much more reasonable democratic pattern. But he did not do it.
Well, there is something in that, but I don't myself think that it's as simple as that. If the Afrikaner government had not quite got in 1948, they would have next time round.
Well, they would have had the balance not changed.
Yes, but the constituencies helped them, but it doesn't account for everything. Oh, and yeah. It certainly doesn't today, where in the last election the government did have a majority of the votes, and although they lost some of their old supporters in their own Afrikaner community to even more right-wing parties, they got a lot of support from English-speaking South Africans.
Because there's no alternative. That seems at least rational to English speakers at the moment. That is the primary problem. But you see, in the past, under the South African Party and the United Party, up to 1948, you always had a large majority of the British-speaking, the English-speaking population, and you always have at least 10% of the Afrikaners, who you might call them the anglicized type, who vote with them. That is why we went to war by 13 votes in 1939. And that is why South Africa had more men proportionately in the forces during the war, although there was no conscription, than any other country bar possibly New Zealand.
But I still wouldn't think it a realistic development that an opposition party amongst the whites could replace the present Afrikaner government.
I think with the correct policy it could, because the great trick which you commented upon was a direct consequence of the abolition of slavery, which in those days was far ahead of any Afrikaner thinking, as we would say, rather likely the Black Majority rule. The Boer War came about for another reason, which is directly analogous to what is occurring. You may remember the Eight Lunder question. What was happening is legitimate immigrants, white immigrants at that time, were outnumbering the Transvaalers, and therefore they kept gerrymandering the vote, 5 years for citizenship, 10 years for citizenship, 30 years, because they did not want their country, as they called it, to be overcome or run by non-Afrikaners. And that is precisely the situation today. So they fought the Boer War when they had a 3-1 majority on the ground. But because of the beautiful ability, fortunately, the Afrikaners to shoot themselves in the foot, instead of going through the sea, which they could have done, and greatly altered the terms of the peace, they besieged Mafeking, they besieged Ladysmith, they besieged Kimberley, all utterly futile and unnecessary, and enabled troops to come into containment. And in my judgment, having watched the Afrikaners for years, the only solution in South Africa is likely to be by violence. Because as Churchill said in the other context, the Afrikaners tend to be either at your feet or at your throat.
Well, it's a sad conclusion if it's right, that the only outcome is likely to be a violent one. And I can only say, I hope not. I mean, you may be right, and it's entirely possible, but I think our actions, you know, in the West should be such that we don't increase the chances of it having to be a violent solution, but see what we can do to help it be a peaceful one. And I mean, that in fact is, that explains some of the things we have done or some of the things we haven't done. Perhaps I can just mention one case when it certainly was tried from outside. This was the Commonwealth mission sent by the Commonwealth countries to South Africa in early 1986, which has been the one real attempt from outside at mediation, and it got a certain distance because the South African government were persuaded against their initial feelings to allow that mission to come to South Africa at all. That left to themselves, the South African government would have said, no thank you, we don't want these outsiders. And to my mind, an example of influence from outside was the effort made by the British government, perhaps others, to persuade the South African government to let that mission in. They did, they let it in, but once it got close to doing anything useful in terms of getting dialogue going between black and white, at that point the South African government torpedoed it by raids into Zimbabwe and Zambia against ANC targets, which made it impossible for the Commonwealth mission to go on. So my point in mentioning this is that there is a possible role from outside for some kind of mediation, and I think we should bear that in mind, but the primary moves must be within South Africa, and the assistance from outside can only be a small part of getting any real dialogue going. It can only build on openings being made by the South Africans themselves, white and black.
Since you've sparked a little touch of controversy, let me introduce another one.
Only a little touch, I must say.
The Reagan administration has been criticized, as I understand it, on Mozambique, not from the left, but rather from the right, for the choice of an envoy who would have as one major responsibility this Western relationship with the government of Mozambique. Have you had political controversy of that kind within Britain about how Britain is to relate to Mozambique?
No, but it was a little surprising at first that the British government began trying to give substantial economic help, at least, to a Marxist-led government in Mozambique. And it goes back to the days when Machel, of the Mozambique leader, was instrumental in getting the Rhodesia problem successfully negotiated at Lancaster House, leading to the independence of Zimbabwe. And Michel showed himself a practical man who was able to compromise. And subsequently, when he clearly indicated that he was uncomfortable being so dependent upon the Russians and couldn't he break clear of them a bit and get some Western help, Mrs. Thatcher, I think, went out on a limb in saying this is something worth doing. And it continued under his successor, Chisano.
She went public with that.
She went public, and I think was the first of the Western leaders to take this view, which maybe is not so popular here.
Well, do you think that the ANC moves toward violence to the white community is going to harden the South African view, or will it be more effective in changing the policy of the South African government?
Well, the South African government are adamant that they're not going to be moved by the ANC, and especially if it's because of violence. Mm-hmm. And there is violence. White opinion is divided. Some whites think we'll have to talk to the ANC in the end, so we might as well get to know them and explore things. But a majority of whites, I think, are very distrustful. And it is a fact that if a bomb goes off, you know, in a supermarket or something, and white shoppers are killed, that white opinion hardens even more that these are not the people that we can deal with. The pity is that the South African government have left the ANC no political role. That is prohibited. The ANC are not allowed to operate. They are not allowed to have representatives within South Africa. So all they're left with is this wretched use of violence. So, but, you know, one must blame the South African government for overreacting and not allowing this political safety level.
General Guest.
Along that line, is it practical to grant political equality to the blacks, even over a long time, you gradually a long time, without the blacks taking over the government? And if they take over the government, can the white lifestyle and economy exist?
I think that's a question which many whites ask themselves, and they can't clearly see the answer. And that's why they are so unwilling to go down this slippery slope, because they don't know where it's going to end. And they imagine that they may be thrown out, or the country will go to rack and ruin under a black government. At the minute, it would be possible, I believe, for a compromise to be worked out, which leaves whites still able to enjoy a decent life in South Africa, as has happened in Zimbabwe, where whites continue to farm and continue to be businessmen and continue to be academics and so on. It wouldn't be as good as now. I mean, white living standards would go down. The economy might not run as well. Whites would have to get used to blacks being a majority and therefore being able to decide most things. And it is still possible that that sort of deal could be worked out. The tragedy is that if you wait 5 years, 10 years, 20 years before the whites are prepared really to say, all right, we'll have to do it, it may then be too late. Because the blacks, meanwhile, will have moved on.
Any other, Helen?
What do you think would be the effect if Nelson Mandela was released from jail?
Nobody knows, and I'm sure the government have weighed this and tried to calculate whether they can release Mandela. There's been a release of one of the people who were with him, Mbeki, just recently, and it may be a test run. I think it is possible that Mandela will be released. There would be a great upsurge of enthusiasm, you know, in the black townships. Mandela is out. But the thing which really matters, and that could run out of control. I mean, that's what the government, the people, you know, the police chiefs will say, we can't answer for what would happen in the black townships if Mandela's released, they all go wild. That's the government's worry. But what really matters is whether by releasing Mandela, the government can then persuade Mandela and other blacks to come and talk to them at the conference table and start a process of real dialogue. And my own suspicion is that the government may mishandle this opening that they may release Mandela and say, we've done what you've all been asking, you know, you in the West and you blacks, we've released Mandela, and now you can come and talk to us. And the blacks will say, no, that's not enough. And the tremendously valuable opportunity that is presented by release of Mandela will be wasted. I would hope that if he is released, the government will have got some more moves in mind, perhaps discussed very quietly with people on the black side in advance, which will take them beyond just releasing Mandela and be enough to make it possible for blacks to come to the conference table feeling that they, the blacks, have a fair chance of equal dialogue with the government. Now, what those moves may be might involve allowing the ANC to operate again politically within South Africa, and certainly releasing a lot more of the people who are now either in prison or held without trial, who could be part of any dialogue. So I think it's a very important step, which could lead on to something, won't in itself be enough, and is in there's a danger of it being thrown away, so to speak, by the government, unless it's very carefully pre-planned what would follow after that in terms of moves towards dialogue.
Professor Redden.
If I could bring you back to one of the earlier points regarding South African nuclear weapons development.
Mm.
Botha announced in September that South Africa would enter into negotiations leading toward ratification of the non-proliferation treaty. Is this a tactical measure to gain leverage in the West, or are we really on the verge of something very significant?
Well, I don't know, and I left South Africa in July before this, so I haven't had a chance to really talk to anyone at that end about it. One has to be rather cautious. It's a lot easier for them to say, we are prepared to talk about our joining, that is, becoming a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Those talks could be stretched out over a long period. The South Africans could say, you know, we have this and that, which will have to be agreed first. And until we're actually there, I shan't really believe it, because it would be a substantial step for them to sign that treaty. And nothing till now seemed to make it likely that they would. They were prepared to talk about having international inspection of the enrichment facility, which I talked about. But that's been going on for quite a long time, and even that, which is a lesser step than signing the Non-Proliferation Treaty, hasn't led to agreement.
I have a question.
Yeah, person.
I was wondering what you think the role of the unions would be, since I guess they were allowed to, black unions were for the first time allowed to become legal in 79. They advocate sanctions. Is that the majority of the unions? What role do you think they would play in the process?
Do you mind if I turn my back so that I can shout it out that way? You'll hear. This is about unions, particularly the black trade unions, you mean. They are very important because they are the one form of organised activity which is quasi-political, which the government have allowed. And in fact, that activity is becoming more political for the very reason that it is the only channel open for people to make political points for the blacks. I'm sure that we will hear increasingly about the role of black unions. In retrospect, it may be a surprise that the government some years ago opened the way for black trade unions, because I think the government nowadays must be rather regretting that there is this form of activity where blacks can take the lead, they can speak as equals, and can become increasingly political. However, they are there at the minute. They've had one or two displays of strength which show that they are a force to be reckoned with. And the government have made life difficult, though not impossible, for the umbrella organisations of the unions, particularly the biggest one, COSATU. It's a kind of federation of trade unions, black trade unions, and the government have detained some of its people. They've made life difficult for it. Mysteriously, the headquarters building had a bomb in the basement which destroyed the printing presses. And I think that will go on. You know, there will be constraints, difficulties, obstacles, restrictions put in some respects on these black trade unions, but probably not to the point of making it impossible for them to operate. So I do think they will be increasingly significant, and we will see some really major challenges by the trade, black trade unions, to the big companies, and certainly a repeat of the mining strike of just a few weeks ago, where the black trade unions didn't win, but they didn't lose either, and they will certainly come back and use their power. I do think that the business of sanctions, which you just mentioned, puts the black unions across a barrel, because they don't, I mean, they represent their members, they have an interest in their jobs, and they don't actually want to lose their jobs and be worse paid and so on, because the economy is running down. So they have no economic interest in sanctions, the very opposite. But because they are now political animals, they really have to take the view, along with other people in the black community, that yes, sanctions would be a good thing, even though privately they can't really want them.
Mr. Burkett Miller believed and urged that the Miller Center should conduct discussions on any contemporary problem of national or international importance, provided two ingredients were present. One, a speaker of wide and deep experience in the problem who could share his knowledge with the group, and two, a group who represented a broad spectrum of opinion and outlook on the problem. And I think his wisdom has been borne out today. We're terribly grateful to Sir Patrick and Lady Moberly for joining us, and to Professor Morford for making all of this possible. This is a problem which sometimes lends itself to demonstrations and takeovers. Perhaps the hope of the future is that it lend itself at least as much to reasoned discussions such as the kind we've had today. Thank you, Sir Patrick.